Could I start the next event by introducing the speaker, who is John Holstead, who is secretary of the Sheffield Cooperative Party. You might know that the Cooperative Party is a political party to support the cooperative movement and has an electoral agreement with the Labour Party. But John, by background, is both a historian and a social scientist. And he's going to divide the talk into two parts. The first part will be concerned with the cooperative movement and the different types of cooperatives and the political structure. And following that first part, we'll have a short time for any questions. And then he will talk about his experience of being involved with a social care cooperative. And following that, we hope there'll be time for to take questions and a discussion. So if I can hand you over to John.
Good morning. Thanks very much for inviting me. And let me say first that congratulations to the Occupy movement, because it seems to me that you're making a political difference. I can't imagine that the leaders of the main political parties would be running around in the way that they are, trying to compete with each other to be critical of capitalism, if it weren't for the Occupy movement. Because one of the key points, I think, about our politics is that we're dominated by London and Parliament and the media. And all of our politicians in Westminster are busy watching the latest move that the journalists make on the television or in the newspapers. We all know about Mr. Murdoch, of course. Watching for the latest move from their next focus group meeting, and they don't say boo to a goose, except now that they're competing, as I say, to do something about the unacceptable face of capitalism, as Ted Heath mentioned many years ago. Perhaps the first thing I should say is that on Thursday of this week, it was my 76th birthday. So I've been around in politics a long time. I actually studied at London School of Economics under the personal tutorship of Ed Miliband's father, Ralph Miliband. The boys are not quite the same as the father, though I didn't always agree with the father about everything. He was a little close on occasions, or he was flattered, shall I say, by a visit to the Soviet Union once, even though he wasn't actually himself a member of the Communist Party of this country. Okay, so I'd like to say a little about what I think are perhaps some of the main political points about the cooperative movement. Cooperation, of course, has a long, long history. In its origin, it's said that the Fenwick weavers in Argyll formed the first cooperative. They formed a society in 1761 to improve standards in the weaving trade that they were all, as a community, engaged in. And then in 1769, they commenced bulk purchase of food and of books. And that is held to be the origin of the first cooperative. Interestingly, they were concerned with the mind as well as the stomach. And of course, the Fenwick Library was created as a result of these book purchases in 1808. So that's what communities were like in those days. People were more isolated, it's before the railway and all of that kind of thing. And you had to hang together. And they did. Now, things developed later. Cooperation is held to be very often a creature of Robert Owen, the famous cotton capitalist of New Lanark in Scotland, because he was interested in the education, the improvement, and the discipline, of course, of the people who worked for him. And he certainly was philanthropic and did good things. So from his publication of New View of Society in 1814, a great deal of interest in his ideas developed amongst people, and people who were referred to subsequently as Owenites emerged. In other words, followers of Owen, though they didn't always follow him in every respect, and they were responsible for the creation of initiatives themselves, in some ways different from Owen's. In Edinburgh, down in London, and of course famously in Brighton, in the 1820s, George Mudie in Edinburgh, who went to London in 1820, Dr. William King of Brighton, who became famous because he created a cooperative store in Brighton in 1827, but also quite a great reputation because he started in 1828 the publication of a cooperative journal called The Cooperator. And so it developed from that point on. So there's a lot of activity before the emergence of the Rochdale Pioneers in 1844 and the development of retail cooperation as a well-established, vigorous movement from that point on. The 1820s, and this is perhaps my first political point, was, especially after December 1825, in the West Riding, a period of great economic distress because in those days the Bank of England didn't issue banknotes, and a number of country banks that issued their own banknotes, rather like the financial crisis in a sense today, collapsed, creating chaos for ordinary people in their lives. And out of that chaos, many people started cooperative organisations, both in order to produce and manufacture the goods that they wanted to sell, but also in order to buy in bulk necessities, food and so on and so forth. And sometimes producer and retail cooperation was combined within the same organisation in that period. Though, of course, eventually it was retail cooperation, hence the cooperative group today that we know, that became dominant throughout the 19th century. Producer cooperation wasn't quite so successful. So there are two types of cooperation emerging out of financial collapse and economic distress, which I think is a parallel to today. And this is why some of the politicians are now expressing an interest in cooperation, because we're in another period of austerity. And it's probably why a lot of ordinary people in society are also getting interested in it, because we've somehow got to create a decent living for ourselves. And perhaps China, that's nice, isn't it? Communist capitalism. With China and everybody else competing with us very, very hard indeed, we've got to somehow raise ourselves by the bootstraps. I'm reminded really of Japan. After the Meiji Restoration in 1867, when the Japanese decided that if they didn't do something, all of these foreign devils would take them over and subjugate them because of their greater military superiority, the Japanese decided to learn from what was going on overseas. And they, in fact, raised themselves by the bootstraps, as it were, into an economic power, almost to challenge America in the 1980s. Things have gone a bit sour since. But that's the situation, perhaps, that we're in now, hence some interest in cooperation. One of the problems of the early cooperators was whether the people involved, secretaries and that sort of thing, might embezzle the funds. This was a common problem in all working-class organisations, trade unions and the like. So recourse was sought for to get protection, and it was eventually given by registration, supervision by the Registrar of Friendly Societies. From that point on, a great deal of legislation has been passed, known as Industrial and Provident Society legislation. And that has been developed a little as well since 1997. And really, we get two kinds of organisation. The first is cooperatives, pure and simple and proper, where the workers themselves are members of the cooperative, and they run the thing and they manage the thing on democratic lines. And, of course, they're in a business like Sumo Foods, where they're manufacturing food, peanut butter and all of that kind of thing. They're competing in the market with other kinds of capitalist manufacturing companies. Private limited companies, public limited companies. That kind of organisation isn't really in the majority. The full-blown workers' cooperative isn't the majority. Most industrial and provident societies are of a second type, whereby they are formed in order to promote some kind of community interest. Now, this can be, of course, the interest of a particular section of the population. I'll speak about that a little later when I talk about social care. But now we've got a new kind of organisation called the Community Interest Company as well in the recent legislation. Now, I don't want to go into details of that kind of thing because that's boring, and in any case, I'm not an expert on it. But we can perhaps discuss that sort of thing. And so we've got a more varied set of legal forms now than we used to have, and the problem of embezzlement has by and large disappeared. The problem, however, of running an organisation successfully and competitively against capitalist enterprises, but also, of course, very often against other cooperative-type enterprises, still remains. So you have to have good management. But what distinguishes this kind of organisation is the fact that you're not allowed to make investments which result in profit to shareholders. Under an industrial and provident society, you may have shareholders in the organisation, but the shareholder doesn't receive a dividend on the basis of the capital that he's invested in the organisation in the way that it happens in an ordinary capitalist organisation. So, with the cooperative group, of course, when we say that the members receive a dividend, that's different from the kind of dividend that we're talking about when we talk about shareholders receiving a dividend because of the capital that they've put into a private limited company. In the case of the cooperative group, you're getting a dividend on the basis of the purchases that you've made. And the amount of dividend that you get is based on the amount of purchase that you've made. So you don't get the dividend as a return for the capital that you've invested. And of course, with private companies, it's very often for one individual an extremely large amount of capital that is invested. Hedge funds and the like, as we know, operate secretively and invest large amounts of money indeed. Now, what is it that's made the world very different since the Second World War? Why is there this greater interest in corporation? I'd like to put it to you that the main reason for this is because under neoliberalism, since Mrs. Thatcher of 1979, in other words, the idea has got round that public provision is a bad thing. Local authorities shouldn't be providing us with services. They should just be commissioning services. They should be enablers rather than providers. So in Sheffield, even when Labour had control of the city council and Bob Kerslake was the chief executive, the refuse collection service disappeared from the local authority and was outsourced to Viola, a profit-making company, of course. The Kier Group was set up to do all the work that in the old days a direct labour department would have done. And now, of course, the City Council has said that it wishes to be a cooperative group, a cooperative council. But the councillors don't have much of a clue as to what that means. They're trying to promote social enterprise in the city, and this seems to be part of what they mean. The problem with that is that there are two kinds of social enterprise. If I can refer back to Ted Heath again about the unacceptable face of capitalism, there's perhaps an unacceptable face of social enterprise, but there's an acceptable face as well. There are, because of the legislative changes, now opportunities for people who have been business people to dive in and run a social enterprise. But the question is, do they run it in the same way or differently from the kind of social enterprise that we would regard as acceptable? It's a question of values. The point about a cooperative is that if it's to be successful and if it's run democratically, everybody inside it has to be committed to the values of the service that they're offering. Customer service really means something inside this kind of organisation. And if you get that wrong, you fail. Of course, capital enterprises also mouth that they're in favour of good customer service, but in practice, they have all sorts of incentives to do something different. They have incentives. Well, I'll talk a bit more about this in relation to the social care field, so I'll just leave that for one moment. But to come back to the point about the values, if the people in a democratically run organisation are not committed to those values, then that can bring the organisation down. So there's a big need for training, for constant effort to ensure that the values are firmly held within the organisation. So that's an internal problem. But there is an external problem as well. When retail cooperation was very firmly established, certainly it was by the time of the First World War, after the First World War, a counter-attack was mounted by commercial retail organisations. And they put pressure on Parliament to change legislation affecting cooperatives. And they had some success. I think Michael McGowan, who's with us over there, is from Leeds, and he tells me that when cooperation started in Leeds, that was in order to deal with the problem of food adulteration. And they started, first of all, with flour milling, I think, in order to make sure that people had ethically produced food. This goes back to Robert Owen as well, who was in favour of that kind of thing. But then, when the commercial interests found that cooperation was being quite successful in dealing with them, they infiltrated the organisation and warrened it and undermined it from within. So that's one of the problems about having a democratic organisation, because, of course, people entered who weren't properly committed to the values of the other people who'd actually created the organisation. And externally, if the rules can be changed by Parliament to the disadvantage of the cooperative movement, that's also a problem. So politically, it's necessary to organise to make sure that those pressures can be countered, defeated, indeed, that we can advance the cause of cooperation even further. Karl Marx would have seen cooperation as part of the revolution, because this was taking capital out of private commercial hands. So that's the kind of situation we're in. And now the threat, as well as the opportunities, are greater than ever. The local authorities didn't always provide the best of service, as those of you who had elderly relatives at some stage in old people's homes or some place like that may have seen from your own experience. But if the local authorities are to depart from these services, we've got to be very, very careful indeed that whoever provides these services instead are well managed, well run, committed to the right kind of values, and indeed offer a better service than any that we've experienced in the past. I think that's possible, but I'll stop at that point. Thank you very much.
Are there any questions on this first part before John talks more about his experience as part of a social care cooperative? Are there any particular questions that...
I'm just following your last point, John. What would you recommend as a change in the law, a new change in the law, that would actually make the cooperative movement more successful and less
done? Well, I think that there are certain areas of provision that I'd really like private enterprise in the capitalist sense to be excluded from. The problem with private enterprise is that the managers are incentivized to increase their own incomes to stratospheric levels. So they engage in arrangements with the Abu Dhabi Investment Fund, let's say, to take over the ownership of the property. And then they they get themselves into big trouble because they've taken on too many debts. So the market for corporate control, as I'd like to put it, is a real threat to the provision of quality service. So I'd like to see that excluded. Whether politically that's on is a difficult kind of question. Difficult kind of question. That's one answer, but there are perhaps more.
What if I could just add to that the cooperatives are many different kinds, and one of the kinds, of course, are the banking cooperatives, which we call credit unions. Now, new legislation has come in this month, in fact, on the 8th of January, which gives credit unions much more power to develop. Until this month, you either have to have a credit union that related to a particular occupation, there are, for example, police credit unions, or limited to a particular area. I'm from Leeds, and I was invited to be work or live in the city. Now, that has changed, so that it's possible now for a much broader constituency. Besides that, until this month, only individuals to be members of credit unions, and now groups will be able to, such as housing associations, woodcraft folk, the scouts, the church group. So this is a fantastic opportunity. And it's one of the great things about support what you said about the great thing that the Occupy movement has done has really been challenging the casino banking sector and has successfully persuaded people to shift resources from the commercial high street banks that support and to keep clear of the loan sharks and the payday ones and shift to either the cooperative bank or to credit unions, which are owned by the members. So when people say there isn't an alternative to the banking system we have, there is. There's a cooperative now. And I think this, John, there are changes taking place. It's a fantastic opportunity for the cooperative movement in general. But I think the alternative to the banking system, and it's this kind of initiative that I think is a next stage for the Occupy movement. And the Occupy movement has got this on the agenda of political parties and the
It seems to me that change in the legislation is important because it does increase the competitive power of cooperation as against the payday lenders and loan sharks. But there are two further points, perhaps. If the government, Parliament, won't outlaw these payday people completely, very often it's American money behind them, if they won't outlaw them completely, then we need a campaign within communities that demonises them and chases them out of the community. And this is where the Occupy movement can be very helpful indeed.
Let me see if I can just add, the great thing about the Occupy movement, it is involved in direct individual non-violent action.
Sure.
And whereas as movements we're trying to stop the Iraq war intervention, we're trying to persuade governments, shifting resources and putting your money in a member-owned bank is something individuals can do, whatever governments or the European Union or the United Nations do. And I think this is giving a lot of us confidence in the Occupy movement to do precisely that. Each individual can do that. Forget the high street banks, you can avoid that. And instead of just campaigning with the government or hoping and praying, you have to get on with it the same way as the Occupy movement. I mean, this is besides demonising and demonstrating that people are sometimes paying thousands and pounds of interest when they get a fair deal from member-owned and reliable financial.
I'm always convinced that under a capitalist system, there's an awful lot of wasted resources. And I thought with cooperatives, you could, when we have austerity, then resources will be much more fairly kind of utilised and distributed. Could you comment, please?
I'm a little bit unsure how to reply to that.
How much of the directors of the co-op made?
How much have they made?
Paid.
Well, I don't know. Steve is more knowledgeable about the cooperative group, but they are paid well.
Annually, there is an annual report.
Yeah, there's a general problem, isn't there, about the relationship between pay at a relatively low level within organisations and top pay. And, of course, we know it's got completely out of hand, and I don't think the cooperative group is necessarily completely immune from that problem.
Got a question. There was a discussion on the radio the other day about these payday loan companies, and it was said they were thinking about sort of outlawing them like a year or two back. They decided not to because these things were necessary because if people broke, if people didn't have these payday loan companies, they would go to doorstep lenders, many of them were kind of outside the law, violent in their methods of getting the money back. Perhaps we need to campaign against those as well.
Yeah, I take the point, but it's a political failure, isn't it? You see that credit unions were in existence back then, and none of the political parties have thought, well, how do we develop this kind of thing as a socially valuable network? And you see, many people in difficulties, they go to citizens' advice, don't they? And people, they get advice there on debt problems and this kind of thing. Now then, Citizens Advice Bureau receives money from central government, doesn't it? So, you know, government could advise Citizens Advice Bureau to advise people not to have anything to do with these payday things, but to go to the credit unions. So action is possible if only people got their heads round it.
You said none of the political parties. I believe the Green Party favours credit unions.
Oh, they may do. But I meant the parties that have been in office.
Yeah. I wonder, should we move just to hear John's experience of working with the social care corps?
Well, since 1994, I've been involved with an outfit called the Enable Group, which is based in Derbyshire. In the 1980s, there was the government appointed a woman who got a nursing background called Lady Cumberledge to look into the question of care in the community. The history in the 19th century, of course, is that families very often sent hysterical female members of the family into asylums. And, of course, they weren't really mad. Very often people were placed in these asylums for the rest of their lives from their 1920s. This is a tragic and sorry tale. The same kind of thing happened to people with learning difficulties. In the 1980s in Derbyshire, there was a hospital called Whittington Hall Hospital that had wards with long-stay patients who were people, very often women, but not entirely, who'd been put there because they had learning difficulties. and it was felt that they couldn't care for themselves, so they were placed in these wards. Just like elderly people were put on long stay, geriatric wards as they were called, in hospitals like Nether Edge Hospital in Sheffield. And the move developed to get people out of these institutions because it was recognised that people were being institutionalised. Their lives were being cramped, their ability to develop and do things was being stunted by being placed in this kind of situation. So as a result of the Cumberledge report, some people in the National Health Service in North Derbyshire and the local authority decided to close Whittington Hall Hospital and transfer members of the community, members of the hospital, patients in the hospital, into the community so that they could live independently. And that's what the Enable Group has been about, and we've successfully done that. Transferred, I just forget how many people it was now, but well over 100 people, and the service has developed, and now it's a big organisation which has been providing housing and care for a large number of other people, in addition to these people who came out of the hospital. So there's been an improvement in our attitude towards people with this kind of problem, even though you still do get a lack of understanding in parts of the community. But the key to it is providing people with a good, secure living environment, with a home. Good care follows from that security. And the advantage of it is that busybodies, government inspectors, all sorts of people can't actually invade that person's home and inspect them and decide that they need less money without permission because it's their property or their tenants. So they've got all of the kind of legal rights that anyone would have. And this is the basis for good care. The Southern Cross affair, of course, which relates to old people's homes, not simply people with learning difficulties, illustrates how things can go wrong. Because that was a case where hedge fund money was put into a commercial company. They wanted to grow. They were taking on properties, growing very large indeed, because the larger they are, the higher the pay for the chief executive. And they acquired all of these borrowings and they went into collapse. The problem, of course, is, well, we've got all these people. What's going to happen? Are they going to be decanted somewhere else? And the problem is that when somebody's elderly, if they're required to move into another home, that, in fact, can be the trigger for their death. Because if they're in a nice environment that they like and they feel safe in, to move them somewhere else is a threat. And that can bring about the psychological and, indeed, the physical collapse which makes them die. I can quote a personal example of a professor from Hull University that I had a great deal to do with over the years, who was affected in just this way. So I think that social care is an area where private companies should not be allowed in, because you want the managers of the people in the organisation providing for these people to be incentivised to do nothing but concentrate on giving good care to the customer. If they've got any other kind of incentive, things will go wrong.
can we just throw this open to a general discussion if anybody wishes to make any points?
For people in Sheffield, I thought I'd mention a couple of cooperatives that are relatively newly set up in Sheffield. One is the Hazelhurst Community Supported Agriculture Co-op, that's at hazelhurst.coop. And that's looking at growing food, organic food for people in the Sheffield area, and it's a kind of farming project that people can get involved with and help out produce food. So for more information about that, go to hazelhurst.coop. Another one is a co-op that I work for that actually hosts the Occupy Sheffield website and the Occupy wiki that the conference has been sorted out on, and that's webarchitects.coop. And again, it's a cooperative with kind of ethical social aims and to provide an alternative to kind of corporate internet service providers.
Could I mention two co-ops as well? Sheffield Renewables and Portland Works.
And should any of you wish to begin to think about setting up a co-op, there is actually a Sheffield Cooperative Development Group, which is an organisation that was set up with the help of the City Council in the 1980s, which is provides advice and help in setting up a co-op, but can also provide loans to cooperatives in a way that the commercial banks would not offer.
Could I just add to that point? There is an Industrial and Provident Society being set up in Sheffield called Mutual Support. And that is interesting in relation to social care, because what's happening in the social care field is that people are all going to get personalised budgets. So if you're receiving care, instead of the local authority receiving the money to spend on you, you will get the budget personally, which then you spend by giving the work to X, Y, or Z, who will not be the local authority, perhaps. So mutual support will allow you to become a member of the cooperative and therefore have a voice in managing the people who are providing your care. So that relates to the housing co-op situation.
could I say thank you to John for coming to talk to us, and thank you for attending.
My pleasure. Every success.